First of all, forgiveness is a moral virtue. That means it deals with goodness deliberately toward other people. That's what a moral virtue is, whether it's justice, you're fair toward others, or patient, wait and don't condemn, kindness. And if it's a moral virtue, then it has to be goodness toward someone or some group or some people. And it so happens, and that's why it's controversial, forgiveness is goodness toward those who have not been good to you.
Welcome to the Upwards Podcast, where we explore the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. In today's episode, we're diving into a most challenging and transformative practice, forgiveness. Our guest is Dr. Robert Enright, a pioneer in the scientific study of forgiveness and founder of the International Forgiveness Institute. Bob shares his remarkable journey from asking a dangerous question about the purpose of his research to becoming a global leader in forgiveness education. We discuss what forgiveness is, what it is not, and why it matters to individuals and communities. Listen now for how it can bring freedom and healing, even in the most challenging circumstances.
Dr. Enright, welcome to the Upwards Podcast. Thank you for being with us.
My honor to be with you, Jean. Thanks for asking
me. Thank you. And I will be calling you Bob for the rest of this because that's a little bit easier. I appreciate that. But so before we get into kind of definitionally what is forgiveness and all the things we talked about in the talk you gave in Oshkosh, I'd like to hear a little bit of your background and how you first got into the study of forgiveness, because you are a world-renowned pioneer in the study of forgiveness and was one of the first people to do that. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I was hired at the University of Wisconsin in Madison all the way back in 1978 to study moral development within the Department of Educational Psychology. And I was a very obedient academic, and I studied what everybody else was studying, which was basically how children and adolescents think about justice and grow in their complexity of thinking about justice as they develop or get older.
Okay.
And I published in that area. I had grants. I got tenure doing that. I was a fair-haired academic.
Yeah.
And all was well in academia except for one thing. I woke up one day and asked myself what I call a very dangerous question. Who am I helping with all the research I'm doing? And the answer was, oh, a couple of my professional buddies. We meet at conferences, pat ourselves on the back for our latest publications, and then we go back to our own laboratories helping no one.
Yeah.
So I decided at that point to, as I say, throw all my research over a cliff. And I've literally never gone back and read even one sentence of anything that was very, very good to me. And so I had, of course, to come up with something because I'm in a publisher parish university.
Right.
And one day, a graduate student from Brazil came into my office and she said, I'm almost out of money. I need a topic for my master's thesis. And unless I get one quickly, I'm going to go back with nothing. Tell me what to study. So I thought, well, that's not the way it goes. You know, you usually tell me, and right. then I will help you. But because she was in what I would call dire straits, one day I was driving into the university alone in my car, and I prayed to our Heavenly Father for her. So it wasn't for me.
Right.
It had to do with helping her. And I actually got one word back in prayer. And that word was forgiveness.
Wow.
And I still remember kind of leaning back in the steering wheel and saying, forgiveness, because I literally had never thought about it because it wasn't on the board, so to speak, within psychology.
Right.
So in a matter of days, I had to do something very primitive. I had actually had to walk all the way to the library, Jean, to do a computer search of the literature.
Wow.
Because there was no such thing as personal computers.
Right.
So
I remember those days.
Yeah,
well.
Yeah. So there you go, all the way to the library. And so I asked the librarian to do a search of the literature on her big mainframe computer where there's scientific or empirical studies on person-to-person forgiving.
Yeah.
And she came back about a half hour later with a blank sheet of paper, and she said, there isn't anything.
Wow.
And so I had a friend also at the same time do the same thing at his library at the University of Kansas, and he came back with a blank sheet of paper. So I thought, well, psychology's been around for about 100 years, and there's no published scientific work on person-to-person forgiving. This is astonishing. So I started talking with different graduate students, and I got a lot of interest from Israel, Greece, Taiwan, Korea, the United States, and we all formed a what I call a Friday forgiveness seminar, not for credit, where we sat around for many years. I'm a slow learner, Jean, and we asked three questions. What is forgiveness? How do you go about it? And what happens when you do?
Wow.
And that's the beginning of it. But you know what? There was a firestorm. Many in academia thought I had gone down a wrong path with a wrong question. One student came into my office, and she was kind of pale and shook. And she said, I just met a professor in the hall, and he said, don't work with Enright anymore. He's ruined his career with a really loose, fuzzy, irrelevant topic of forgiveness.
Wow.
And he's ruined his career, and you will never get a job in academia if you stay with him. And she said, is that true? And I thought about it and said, you know, it's too new. We can't tell.
Mm-hmm.
And she stuck it out, got a job, tenured. So there you go.
Yeah. Wow. I'm so glad I asked that question.
That
is really a great story.
One word in prayer.
One word in prayer. And not only that, but, you know, I'm a research to practice sort of a person.
Ah.
I don't enjoy doing research,
but
I like to apply
Yes.
the research of others into policy, and that's kind of what I do. So not only did it come from your desire to actually make something useful, imagine that, have research be useful, right? But you also, it was led by your student and in need of your student. So that's beautiful.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing for me. I feel very blessed.
Yeah. Well, and God takes us into unusual places, and he did
Indeed.
That with you.
Yep.
So let's launch into those three questions that you just shared that you started talking about. So what is forgiveness?
Well, first of all, what we did in this Friday Forgiveness Seminar is we took a look at the different ancient writings.
Okay.
We looked at the Hebrew, and we looked at the Christian, and we looked at even philosophical way back, like Confucianism and then Hinduism and Buddhism. And then we looked at modern philosophy.
Okay.
And what we tried to do is synthesize so that what we defined as forgiveness would be compatible with all the different kind of views that existed now for thousands of years.
Okay.
And we came up with the idea, because it was there in print and was preserved, that first of all, forgiveness is a moral virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it deals with goodness deliberately toward other people. That's what a moral virtue is, whether it's justice, you're fair toward others, or patient, you wait and don't condemn, kindness. And if it's a moral virtue, then it has to be goodness toward someone or some group or some people. And it so happens, and that's why it's controversial, forgiveness is goodness toward those who have not been good to you.
Right.
Okay? And you can see that, for example, in the Joseph story in the first book of the Bible, Genesis 27 to 45, I think it is, something like that. And there's just obviously a lot of chapters in there. And Joseph, who was really almost murdered by his brothers, is good to them, right. Okay, where he helps save the Hebrew culture from famine. So that's one example of being good to those who aren't good to you. And that does cut across the different writings. And so we realize, well, what does it mean to be good to those who aren't good to you? And we realized there are six components. First of all, you deliberately, through your free will, try to think good thoughts about the other, feel good feelings. And if the person's present in your life, or if you can indirectly be good behaviorally, to at least be good in terms of being kind to the other. So you have good thinking, good feeling, and good behaving. But at the same time, you get rid of the negative thoughts mm-hmm. of condemnation. You get rid of the negative feelings, of revengeful feelings, and you get rid of the negative behaviors, which is, I'm going to punish this person and make this person pay. Mm-hmm. So when you put those all together, you get rid of the negative, and you offer the positive. But also, I realized I would get in trouble all the time in my early days when I didn't also say what it's not.
Yeah.
Because people always say, how dare you talk about my forgiving my ex-spouse? You want me to go back and be killed by it? No, because forgiveness is not excusing what the other did. What the other did was unfair, is unfair, and will always be unfair. You don't forget. You remember in new ways. You don't develop some kind of amnesia, mm-hmm. okay? So if someone's a gambler and keeps asking for money, you remember that. Mm-hmm. But it passes through your heart without damage when you remember in new ways. Then a big one that really helped settle forgiveness with a lot of people is it's not reconciliation.
Right.
Reconciliation is not a moral virtue. It's a negotiation strategy of two or more people coming together again in mutual trust.
Right.
So if you can't trust the other, you don't reconcile.
Right.
You can forgive. And what does that mean? You try through your free will to have good thoughts, feelings, and behaviors toward that person, keeping your distance, right. and you fight against the negative thoughts, feelings, and behaviors toward the other while keeping your distance, and you don't come together again unless the other is trustworthy.
Right.
And then the fourth issue is when you forgive, you let other moral virtues come up with it. The big one is justice. Mm. Forgiveness and justice exist side by side so that when you forgive, and you have this more tender-hearted response to the other while watching your back, you ask something of the other. You mm-hmm. try to make it fair in terms of what is going on. So you can approach the person without screaming at the person because you have a tender heart, but you say, you know, you've been hurting me by doing this and that and the other. Could we please sit down and work this out? And so the justice actually might be more satisfying when you merge it with forgiveness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But then what if you do have, and this is one of the distinctions I think with reconciliation is if you have someone who doesn't think they even need to be forgiven,
right.
doesn't acknowledge the wrong that they've done to you,
right.
or even someone who's passed away, you know, had that right. as being a challenge for someone. So talk about forgiveness in that situation.
Forgiveness is, in my opinion, as a protection for the forgiver, always unconditional. You forgive without condition. You forgive without the other having to do something to earn it.
Okay.
When Joseph forgave his half-brothers, they didn't apologize. They didn't even know he was Joseph. He mm-hmm. was a leader in Egypt, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. So He had this effusive goodness toward them when they didn't even know it was him. So they didn't apologize. They didn't change anything. So if someone says, get out of here, you're being overly sensitive, if you, in your own heart of hearts, know you've been treated unjustly, you can go ahead and you can go and do that, even if the other says, I'm not going to change my ways because I'm doing nothing wrong mm-hmm. and it's very abusive toward you, then you, again, watch your back. You don't enter back into any kind of close relationship, at least now, mm-hmm. and you can offer this forgiveness, mm-hmm. those 6 points. What if someone's deceased? Can you be good to someone who's deceased? Oh, yes, you can. How about a kind word about the other to others in your community, in your family? Right. You can, in other words, leave somewhat at least of a good name of that person in the family. That's a gift. How about giving something to charity in that person's name? Mm-hmm. That's a goodness extended mm-hmm. to the person. And here's why it's important to be able to forgive in these conditions. If you set up your own rule and you say, I cannot forgive unless there are certain conditions met, right. such as the person being alive and apologizing to me, and you don't forgive until that happens, if the person gets hit by a bus tomorrow and you have all this resentment or hatred, you are now trapped in your heart with this kind of unforgiveness, probably for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. How fair is that?
Right.
And that's why, to me, forgiveness has to be unconditional, which makes sense, because I don't know of any moral virtue on the planet that's conditional. In other words, do you have to only be fair until someone else does something? Mm-hmm. If they're being unfair to you, do you deliberately then practice unfairness?
Right.
Or do you still try to be fair to the other? Do you need someone to say something or do something before you practice patience? No.
Right.
Every moral virtue is unconditional. Why would forgiveness be the exception to that rule and trap you for the rest of your life?
Well, given that, why don't we talk to some of the effects on the forgiver of eventually, as hard as it might be, and we'll go into that a little
sure.
bit later, but what are some of the effects on forgivers when they've been able to forgive?
Okay, we've measured anger, anxiety, depression, hope, self-esteem, and we find that in general, all of these tend to change positively for the forgiver. If taken enough time, going through forgiveness without being too quick about it. I mean, here's a couple of examples.
Yeah.
I mean, Suzanne Friedman, way back when in 1996, it was published in 1996, did a study with female incest survivors. That's one of the cruelest injustices known to humankind mm-hmm. because a father or a father figure who's supposed to protect violates.
Right.
And she recruited 12 women and she randomized 6 to the experimental group to go through the forgiveness process and 6 to just seek treatment as they could. And all of them said, the 6 who were eventually said, we're going to go through a, she said, we'll go through a forgiveness program. They said, I'm not going to forgive. And they're actually being kind to her because they knew it was a study.
Right.
And they were saying, well, I'm going to be the one who's going to mess up your study. And in her kindness, she said, come in anyway. So she met one-on-one with these 6 once a week for about an hour until each one of them said, I have forgiven based on this definition you and I just went
yeah,
through.
Okay.
And it took 54 weeks,
mm-hmm.
so a long, long time, because it makes sense because the pain is so profound.
Right.
And the others, the control group who could seek any kind of therapy they wanted during that basically a year, were all assessed. And those in the forgiveness condition went from clinically depressed, which is a lot of pain, to normal levels. The other group was still clinically depressed.
Mm.
They then went through the program. It took them about a year. And at the end of that, they went to normal levels.
Uh-huh.
And then what happened to those who now didn't have forgiveness for a full year? Okay, as the control group started the program, they were still clinically non-depressed.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it was the strongest results ever published with regard to outcomes for incest. Because at the time, in the mid-1990s, the thinking in psychology was, don't expect too much change.
Mm-hmm.
It's too profound an issue. Well, these women were healed
right.
and just more recently, Lee Fan Yu, YU, who's now at Arizona State. And by the way, Suzanne Friedman's at the University of Northern Iowa. Lee Fan Yu did a study with a team with men in a maximum security correctional institution. Mm-hmm. And we assessed 107 of them. And believe it or not, 90% of them had deep injustices against them in childhood or adolescence that 40% of them never told anybody regarding the pain they had or even what happened. So we brought them down to, I can't remember the exact number, but it was about 10 and 10, 10 to do the forgiveness group and 10 to do really business as usual in the correctional institution, what was handpicked for them. And this one went on for 6 months. And at the end of that, those who had forgiveness started being clinically angry, anxious, and depressed. Same with the control group. And at the end of the 6 months, those who forgave those who abused them went to normal levels. Okay? And their sense of empathy went up in general toward people, which is hard to do in corrections.
Right.
Because a lot of them don't like others because of how they've been treated.
Sure.
The control group that had the hand-picked Department of Corrections intervention were still clinically angry, anxious, and depressed.
Mm.
They then went through the program, the forgiveness program. They went to normal levels, and their empathy went up. And it actually is the strongest mental health improvements in a maximum security correctional institution ever published.
Mm.
Okay? So forgiveness can be a curative factor for very troubling psychological symptoms, but also ends up with this idea of an increase in empathy. Suzanne's also had an increase in self-esteem. The women actually didn't like themselves, Jean.
Right.
Because they were believing the lie about who they are. And they said, wait a minute. See, if I can be good to this, my father figure, if I can see him as having inherent worth, I think I have that kind of worth. And they ended up liking themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of getting rid of the negative and a lot of instituting the positive in a psychological sense when people go through forgiveness in a deep way with enough time, we get good results.
Right. And there's an element of freedom as well. I mean, that, right?
They're free.
I mean,
That's a good word.
You talked about being trapped earlier,
right.
People find themselves trapped
right.
if they're not able to forgive. And
right.
if you get to that point,
yep.
then you're
yep.
free.
In fact, there's a video of one of the gentlemen who was in our maximum security intervention. His name is Sylvester Jackson. And he was in an international conference here at the University of Wisconsin in 2022, and it's on our International Forgiveness Institute website. And he talks about being set free.
Mm.
He was on psychological medications.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I don't need them anymore.
Wow.
And now he's giving back to his community. He's out of corrections. And his job now is helping those coming out of corrections to stabilize and adjust to normal society. He's
mm-hmm.
giving back
right.
to those where he was side by side.
Right, right. You spoke a little bit in your talk before about, I'm thinking about the process, and it is a slow process. I'm imagining that different people take
that's right.
like longer, and it's
correct.
Probably not linear, I'm
correct.
Guessing.
Yeah, absolutely,
right?
You're right.
So back and forth. So one question is, so I think you addressed, when do you know you've forgiven? Is it once and done? Or is there more or are there different levels of forgiveness? And then I have a follow-up question, but maybe start with those two.
Okay. Well, Lewis Smeads, Smeades, and his really classic book now in 1984 called Forgive and Forget, mm-hmm. although he didn't think we forget. The title was given to him. He said, we know we're really on the path of forgiveness when we start wishing the other person well,
mm-hmm.
okay? And we have found in our research here at the UW that practice matters. If people have practiced forgiveness for some time. They're kind of used to it. So when a thunderous injustice comes, they know a pathway. They've tried it. It's familiar to them. Mm-hmm. And so they can be quicker with deeper results. Mm-hmm. If someone hasn't tried it before, they're new at it. I mean, it's kind of like if you're trying to become what I call forgivingly fit, if you're trying to become physically fit, if you haven't done much for a while, you have to start slowly, and it takes more time to reach a level of physical fitness, where if you've been at it for a while practicing it, you can get to another level much more quickly. It's the same thing with forgiveness. Mm-hmm. We all differ, and that's right. Fine. It doesn't mean someone is any less than a person if the person takes 9 months to forgive and someone else takes 2 months.
Right.
The idea is to finish well.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more from Dr. Enright in just a moment. If you are inspired by this conversation and want to introduce forgiveness education into your home, classroom, or community, the International Forgiveness Institute is offering free access to its curriculum guides from pre-K through high school, as well as resources for parents and anti-bullying programs. Just email director@internationalforgiveness.com and mention this podcast. You'll find all the details in our show notes. Now back to the conversation.
So you spoke a little bit, and I could imagine some of those really profound hurts, like incest.
Yep.
I've worked with survivors of human trafficking. Whoa. I've just been astonished at their ability, some of them, not all of them, but to move beyond that in a healthy way and free themselves. But you spoke a little bit as part of that process, learning how to stand in the pain.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about that. What does that look like?
Well, we have what we call 4 phases to the forgiveness process. And the first one is the uncovering phase, where we uncover our own pain. We don't forgive yet. We allow a period of anger or sadness or mourning, just confusion. And then comes the decision phase. Do I want to forgive? Free will choice. Mm-hmm. All the incest survivors, it was all their free will, okay? We go through the definition. Then we hit what we call the work phase. Mm. That's where we hit the forgiveness gym.
Yeah.
And part of the forgiveness gym is standing in the pain.
Right.
And standing in the pain is an idea that wasn't new to our group. Others had talked about that clinically without doing research on it. Even in hospice, you can see it, where when someone's talking about trying to grieve, they talk about leaning into the pain so you don't run from the pain.
Right.
And so after a person has begun to see the other person as a human being, more than just what happened to you, because you might see the person's woundedness, for example, you see a common humanity between yourself and the other, because you know, the forgiver's done wrong too, and that doesn't mean to excuse what the other did, but there's a common humanity of imperfection there.
Mm-hmm.
Once the kind of the drip, drip, drip of the anger starts slowing in the heart of the forgiver, we suggest, it's always up to the forgiver, do you want to stand in the pain by not trying to throw the pain back at the other?
Mm-hmm.
Or, because we've known about the psychological defense from Freudian times of the early part of the 1900s, so you don't displace your anger onto others.
Right.
Where you go home and yell at the spouse, or you yell at the kids, or you yell at the coworkers because of what's in your heart. And people see, oh, yeah, I have sometimes displaced and been impatient with others because of my own pain.
Right.
So we ask, would you like to be aware of that? And like to be aware you might want to get back at the other, but stand in that pain so you can now become a conduit of good in the next part of the work phase, so you don't displace it or throw it back. So as Gandhi would say, if you keep taking an eye for an eye with one another, the whole world will be blind if we all do that. So do you want to be someone who stops the transmission of pain with you?
Mm-hmm.
And when a person does that, that starts to be curative because the people conclude this, you know, I'm stronger than I thought I was. I can stand in this pain. And it's, I use an example in one of my books of a sponge that's soaked with water. It's heavy and it's messy and it seems like it's always going to be there. But if the sponge stands there, eventually that does, the water evaporates and it becomes dry. Well, the same thing happens, and see, hospice is aware of that too, and they say lean into the pain. As you bear the pain, eventually and paradoxically, it seems like a contradiction, but it's not. But paradoxically, as you take on this pain willingly, the pain starts to leave, and the anger starts to leave, and you realize you can take suffering because you are now stronger than you thought you were. And that's the beginning of being set free from all this baggage that was dumped on you by someone. And it could have been 20 years ago, and you're still carrying the baggage. Standing in the pain helps you get rid of the baggage and lay it down.
Right, right. And also, I would imagine, I like to think of, if you think of absorbing sin of another or evil coming at you, I think of it, if I can absorb that, then I'm and not inflict it out, then I'm like, I'm taking it out of the world.
Like, good point.
It's out of the equation. You know, that's quite an accomplishment.
It is, yes.
And it's a strong thing to do.
That's right.
It's not a weak thing to, I mean, we are weak in our hurts, but that's a strong thing to do, right?
Yeah, I think that's very well put.
Yeah.
Because, see, at first people might say, oh boy, if I take it on, it's like having a big sack of rocks on my back. It's always going to be there. No, somehow, and I still don't understand the process,
right.
Those rocks slowly come out of that bag until there's very little left, if any at all.
Right.
And as you have stood in the pain has left, and you are set free to try and reconcile if the other will let you.
Right.
And at the very least, if not, you're set free and others are not the victims of your pain.
Right.
And that could be innocent victims like one's own children, for example.
Right.
You are actually setting others in your family free when you are less angry.
Well, and I think we've all seen those cycles of even those who have been abused can often become abusers themselves.
That's right.
And so then you have a generational trauma, a generational pattern, and all the more powerful if you can break that pattern.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
The idea that I hear so often, wounded people wound other people.
Right.
So if you say, yes, I'm wounded, and I'm not going to take that woundedness and let it be perpetrated on others, you've done a very heroic thing. And that's why I call forgiveness a heroic virtue.
Right, right, right. So there's another aspect to this that I think we both wanted to touch on, and that's the self-forgiveness piece. So how does that factor in, and how do we go about doing that?
First of all, when you engage in self-forgiveness, you are not forgiving your own sins.
Okay.
That's between God and you.
Yep.
But it's the same thing when you forgive another person. You don't absolve someone of sins. What you do is try to welcome the other back into the human community, see the other's humanity, give the person another chance where you're saying, come out of the pit, take my hand and come out of the pit, so you won't be perpetrating all this mayhem onto others, including me.
Right.
Let's talk about the second chance as you do it with a softened heart, the softened mind, the softened behaviors. You do the same thing when you self-forgive. You say to yourself, come on up out of that pit. Don't keep condemning yourself for what you have done. You are more than this. You are a person of worth, not to excuse and say, oh, I just bilked my whole family out of our life savings. I'm going to forgive myself. It's okay what I did. No, it wasn't okay what you did, but you are a human being who's more than this. And so you, first of all, have more compassion on yourself. You have those positive thoughts, feelings, and behaviors where you don't subvert yourself. you try to get rid of the negative, where you don't have all these condemning thoughts anymore, mm-hmm. condemning feelings toward yourself, or subversive behaviors toward yourself in which people can engage. And so you try to be good to yourself, even though you might say, I don't deserve it. Yes, you do, because you are a human being and all people deserve goodness. Mm-hmm. The difference between self-forgiveness and forgiving others is this. When you have broken your own standards or God's standards, and therefore you have violated justice in the world, usually you have also offended others by what you've done, not just yourself. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very good idea when you self-forgive to ask yourself, who have I offended by what I've done? And go to them and ask for forgiveness. Seek forgiveness, knowing that your seeking is not a demand where the light bulb will go on for that person and they'll automatically and instantaneously forgive you. That person might have to walk a pathway. And also, depending on if the person is a person of faith, seek forgiveness from God.
Well, and that's, I mean, when you think about forgiving ourselves, even those of us who do know we are forgiven by the grace of God, and God's grace is undeserved by definition, right? But that taking that next step of letting it go ourselves is, it could just be really difficult.
That's right. I have heard others who counsel people say that there is a tendency, even when the person is forgiven by God, to not like the self. And so that's why self-forgiveness is that added step to complete this, to set the person free. In other words, if you're working with someone who's been forgiven by God but still is kind of self-condemning, you don't want to say the following: look, God has forgiven you. What, are you bigger than God? Get over it. No.
Right, no.
So, but I hear that, sadly, okay? So we have to be careful and know that those are two different issues.
Right.
But you already have a good beginning because you have the grace from God to now begin to forgive the self. And when it's time to forgive others, you have the grace of God to do that. And be gentle with yourself. Take some time. Again, it's not instantaneous. It's a pathway you follow, as you and I have been discussing. And eventually the person ends up stopping what we call the self-loathing.
Right.
And I am a blogger in it's a national magazine called Psychology Today, and I wrote one essay on self-loathing and self-forgiveness. I was shocked by the high number of views it had.
Wow.
So there's a lot of pain out there with people who are engaging in self-loathing, and that's a lie of the evil one, in my opinion.
Yes.
And so self-forgiveness can help set you free as you seek forgiveness from others and from God.
Well, self-loathing and even self-harm, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. See, that's the deal. Self-loathing can turn to negative behavior, not just negative thoughts and feelings.
Right.
And that's why we have to watch that and work on this so you get rid of those negatives and institute the positives. Positive thoughts about yourself: I am a person of worth. Positive feelings, where you're starting to like yourself. Mm-hmm. And positive behaviors, where you're doing good things for yourself in terms of your health and your relationship.
Right. Okay, so what does forgiveness look like, Bob, when it's more of a injustice at a structural or systemic level?
Okay, of course, that happens all the time.
Right.
I teach a course oftentimes at the university for the Center of Educational Opportunity.
Okay.
And that tends to be students who are first generation ever to go to university in their family.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a lot of minoritized students in, okay?
Sure.
And so I get questions such as this rather frequently. Well, can I forgive those who instituted slavery, which was, you know, well over 150 years ago, and I don't know who they are, and they're long gone, yet I'm feeling it, you know, in terms of, because I'm oppressed.
Right.
Is there a possibility of forgiving on a societal level or a community level? And the answer is yes. And even though you don't know who they are, it's easier, of course, to forgive someone who's living and breathing and right in front of you, and you know that person's history in your own family. But you can see them as human beings who have erred greatly. They have made big mistakes, okay, which probably, you would think, in terms of the consequences, made them miserable as well, because one would think their own conscience would be bothering them. Mm-hmm. Because if, in fact, we are all made in the image and likeness of God, which is Genesis 1, mm-hmm. and we have a conscience that can recognize that, one would think that those who instituted this kind of oppression were bothered by it. Mm-hmm. So you can see that maybe they didn't lead exactly exemplary lives themselves and had their own pain. So you can begin to see them as having worth as human beings because they had the potential, at least, to be good to others, and maybe they were good to some people, not to excuse what they did, mm-hmm. but to realize they are human beings. And again, if the person is a person of faith who's trying to forgive, mm-hmm. well, even they were made in the image and likeness of God, even though they didn't use that well, but they were made in the image and likeness of God. And take the time to reflect on that, where you actually can forgive people you don't know. Mm. And when you do that, that is helping you, because the effects of what happened, think about it.
Right.
Something that happened 200 years ago is still having an effect in individual people's hearts today,
right.
and it's perfectly legitimate, it's perfectly understandable, but a person can be set free from that while still clinging truthfully to what happened was wrong, is wrong, and will always be wrong.
Right.
And now to, with that forgiveness in your heart, fight for a fairness or a justice that hasn't still come yet,
right.
you see.
Right.
But how you fight for that will be different if you're fuming with hatred or you're talking person to person of worth.
Well, and that's another example, potentially flinging the pain around more.
Exactly.
But it doesn't diminish the motivation to fight for
justice, right? Remember, we should let forgiveness and justice grow up together.
Right.
And if those who came to me and said, should I forgive those who instituted slavery? The answer is, if you want to, and you now know the way to do that, but don't give up justice. Forgiveness is not an excuse to lay down and say, everything is okay, walk on my face.
Right.
And no, it's to say, I see there's an injustice, let's right the wrong.
Right.
But how we right that wrong will be qualitatively different if we're not filled with hatred in our hearts.
Right. Share some stories maybe about some of your work at like a community level.
Sure.
And I mentioned, I know you've worked in Israel and Northern Ireland as two examples, but do you have sort of a story to share from some of the transformation you've seen at the community level?
Sure. Well, what we do in Northern Ireland is to help children learn about forgiveness through stories and educational programs on forgiveness that we have developed here, and we transport them over there and to many other countries. And we help children begin to learn about forgiveness so that when they're older, they can fold that into community dialogue. Community dialogue is a big deal and should be ever since the signing of what they call the Good Friday Peace Agreement in 1998. Mm-hmm. And the British soldiers have now left the Northern Ireland community, which is a big step. But the Irish Catholics and British Protestants still are quite segregated. Mm-hmm. And so there's still a lot of work to do. And so we work from mostly in what we call primary schools there, which is elementary schools. And the children actually begin to forgive one another on the playground if they're pushed down. And they actually start having their own worth even. Here's one example. One second grader, which it would be primary four in Belfast, Northern Ireland, talked about inherent or built-in worth of all people. And we're getting to the punchline of even those who might be mean to you, but we didn't get there yet. And one girl let everyone leave, and then she went up to the teacher, and she said, do you mean I'm as good as, I'm not going to use the real name for anonymity purposes, do you mean I'm as good as Johnny, who comes to school very well dressed. And am I as good as Sally, who has two parents where she has one?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not as good as in sports as others. And the teacher looked at her and she said, yes. And she smiled as if this was like a revelation she had never thought about before.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, she was carrying silently all this in her heart. When she looks at people who are better dressed than her,
mm-hmm.
she feels inferior.
Right.
Or someone who can kick a soccer ball better than her. She's seeing herself as inferior. And all mm-hmm. of a sudden now she's seeing that the idea of worth really matters.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we are actually working in Israel. And we are working not between forgiveness between Israelis and Palestinians, Israel and Gaza, because that's too much.
Right.
That's too much too soon. But what we are doing is deliberately working within families to plant forgiveness within families so that this anger is not displaced because of the war onto other family members.
Right.
And we're actually collecting the data now, so I can't tell you if it's working or not.
I bet it is.
Well, that'll be a conversation for the next few months.
Yeah.
We'll see, but we're hoping so. But we're getting very good feedback because the people are very family-centered in Israel,
mm-hmm.
and they are really liking this program because they're planting forgiveness with the children, with the spouses, with uncles and aunts. And so they're letting forgiveness grow at a time when there has been deep, deep problems, obviously, that have existed since that October 7th tragedy.
Right. Well, in some of previous podcasts, too, we've been in conversations about having conversations with people with whom you may disagree or, you know, have done wrong to you or are in another group.
Right.
We tend to, you know, this loving your neighbor. There are different levels of neighbor.
So
it's a similar kind of process. But we do come back to it's sometimes the hardest to communicate and in this case forgive the people closest to you.
That's right. Correct.
So if you can start in your family, you know, your cousin who drives you crazy or your parent who has done you wrong or what have you, that is where it starts. And
yes, it is.
Yeah.
And it's the reason that is because we expect goodness from those in our family.
Right.
And when we're betrayed, that's first of all a shock because of the expectation.
Yes.
And the wounds are deeper. And that's why it's very important to forgive in the family, because otherwise the children grow up. The effects in their heart of anger, if it's not healed, what do? Pass it on to spouse and their children,
mm-hmm.
who can pass it on. And that anger can actually be alive and working in the hearts of the children's children's children.
Right.
And so it's
back
really
to that generational.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's why forgiving now in the family can actually be a gift to future generations that we'll never see because of the passage of time. But something of us, some goodness of us, can be present in our subsequent family 100 years from now.
Yeah, yeah, that's beautiful. It's beautiful. Makes me think, too, of how much easier and valuable it can be to learn a foreign language when you're a child.
Yep.
Because it's that much easier.
Very well put.
And then when you get older, it gets just a little bit harder. Our minds are not as elastic, right?
Yep.
And so back to if people were interested in some of the educational materials that you've developed, how would they find those? We'll put them in the link, but why don't you talk a little bit about the Institute and what you all do?
We have an International Forgiveness Institute, mm-hmm. which is a nonprofit organization, mm-hmm. and you can get to it by internationalforgivenessalluntogether.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then in there is a lot of material, but there are curriculum guides from pre-kindergarten or age 4 up through the end of high school. So that's 14 curriculum guides. And we have an anti-bullying guide and also one for parents. So we have over 14 curriculum guides.
Mm-hmm.
And we usually sell them for $30. But for those who are watching this podcast, they will be able to get any of these or all of them free of charge.
Okay.
Okay. And then they have to go to director@internationalforgiveness.com and ask the director, his name is Mark, M-A-R-C, for whichever ones they want. And we have both secular guides and Christian guides. Mm-hmm. They're the same thing, but they're biblical texts in the Christian guides. And he will then send them electronically.
Okay.
And then people can, if they want, just keep them electronic or just run them off and use them as they wish.
Sure. What a valuable resource. And what's your vision for these curriculum?
The vision for my curriculum, it's a real small one, a tiny one, is that forgiveness should be in every classroom, in every school, in every country in the world, and in every family in the world, because it's more important that we learn about forgiveness than we learn about traditional school subjects such as geography, history, and mathematics. Those are important, but they're not going to destroy us if we don't know them.
Right.
If we don't know how to forgive, we could become so angry, so hate-filled, that we could destroy ourselves or others.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time that forgiveness becomes a natural part of a school curriculum for the good of families and communities and maybe even eventually cross communities between two communities that historically have not gotten along. Can you imagine this, Jean, if two communities that haven't gotten along had forgiveness education in families with adults and children in schools? Then they got together and talked with one another about how to overcome their differences.
Okay.
That might be a whole different way of seeking peace. And it hasn't ever been tried in the history of the world from what I know. I might have missed something.
Mm-hmm.
If I did, I hope someone points it out because that would be hugely important. We have to now fold in forgiveness into the peace movement. And it's way past time for that.
Yeah. Well, I have another friend of mine that I hope to do a podcast on exactly this this aspect of the role of forgiveness in peacemaking. And I first, he does a lot of peacemaking, and he said, it's a really interesting question. So we'll explore that in a follow-on episode.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bob. It's been great to have you on the podcast, and I really appreciate your coming and being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for your great question, Jean. You really got me thinking.
All right. Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Upwards podcast. If today's conversation on forgiveness inspired you, check out the resources from Dr. Enright and the International Forgiveness Institute. Links are in the show notes. Don't forget to subscribe, share this episode, and leave us a review to help others discover these important conversations. Go in peace.